I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you to this, our University of Law alumni speaker event, which is an evening with Joshua Rosenberg. So my name's Jill Howe Williams, and I'm the Dean at the University of Law, and I'm absolutely honoured to be talking to Joshua this evening. So Joshua will be sharing his thoughts with us for about 50 minutes, and then we will have a brief Q&A session at the end, and I really hope that you enjoy tonight's event as much as I know I will. I'm sure you're all familiar with Joshua's hugely successful career as Britain's best known commentator on the law. His achievements are quite exceptional, and therefore, without, I hope, embarrassing Joshua too much, I will, by way of introduction, mention a few of them. So first of all, Joshua is the only full-time journalist to have been appointed as Queen's Counsel Honoris Causa. He's also an honorary master of the bench of Gray's Inn and a non-executive board member of the Law Commission. Joshua's career in law started when he graduated with his law degree from Wadham College, Oxford. And from there, he studied the Law Society finals with the College of Law, as it then was known, and went on to qualify as a solicitor in the 1970s with a very broad practice area covering crime, family, divorce, conveyancing, and other legal aid type work. His career in journalism, which is probably best known, started at the BBC in 1975, and he was the BBC's legal correspondent for 15 years and introduced the regular feature Law in Action, which is still broadcast today. So now he is a freelance journalist. As I'm sure you all know, he writes regularly for The Guardian and the Law Society Gazette, and he holds honorary doctorates in law from the universities of Hertfordshire, Nottingham, Trent, Lincoln, and indeed our own university, the University of Law. He's also managed to fit in the authoring of several books, including most recently Enemies of the People, How Judges Shape Society. Joshua is known for his independence, his authority, and his ability to explain complicated legal issues with simplicity, clarity, and wit. And he was included by The Times in its independently judged list of the UK's 100 most influential lawyers, the only journalist to feature on this list. So I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Joshua tonight to this event.
Thank you, Jill. Nothing left to say, really, is there?
Oh, I think we'll find something for you to say. So I'm going to start off with, I hope, an easy question, which is really just to get you to start at the beginning of your career and to think back to what inspired you, what was the initial spark that made you want to study law in the first place when you went to university?
Well, I hadn't done badly at law at school, which was unusual. I say unusual because I'd done badly at everything else, but I hadn't studied law at school, so there was no problem about that. It seemed an interesting subject. It seemed a practical subject to do. I could see it leading to a career in the law. I was wrong about that, as with many things. But it just seemed something that would interest me. I'd done part of an A level in what was called British Constitution, and I found that very interesting. The rest of it was economics, which I couldn't follow. But British Constitution, how the country worked, I did find interesting. And I found myself, before going to university, working in various solicitors' firms in London during school holidays and things like that. And so it seemed a natural progression.
Now, you went on from Oxford to study your Law Society finals with us. It must have been a little bit of a change. Can you recall any sort of particular favourite memories of studying the Law Society finals, and in particular, any sort of assessment experiences that you'd like to share with the audience?
No, it was not the worst period of my life. That was to come, but it was the second worst period of my life. The College of Law, the London branch anyway, was in a large old house on many levels in a place called Lancaster Gate between Notting Hill Gate and the West End. And you had hard wooden chairs, which were too small, and hard wooden tables, which wobbled. And the teaching method consisted of lecturers who would dictate at just a tiny bit faster than dictation speed, the speed at which you could write down anything. You would have to write down every word they said verbatim in longhand and then memorize it that night. I just couldn't do it. I mean, I had no trouble getting a law degree, but actually, you know, coping with that sort of teaching, having had, you know, a reasonably intellectual 3 years at Oxford, I found very, very difficult. You know, it wasn't a happy time.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, and I hope that the alumni here tonight have had a better experience at the University of Law. And I promise
it's changed a lot.
We certainly don't have hard wooden seats anymore. They've definitely got soft pads. You then went on from the College of Law to do your articles at the solicitors firm Dixon Ward.
Yes.
So can you share some of your experiences as an article clerk racing around London?
Yes.
And what sort of work you were involved with?
I mean, it seems strange now, doesn't it? But, you know, in those days, a firm in a prosperous part of London could not only do legal aid but crime. And so I would regularly visit clients in Brixton Prison, where I happened to be last week for something completely different. I would, just for an hour or two, you understand, listen to Tomorrow's Law in Action to find out. We would do domestic violence. That was quite a new thing. I used to have to issue a divorce petition before you could get an injunction. And I used to write out divorce petitions by hand, and we had counsel who was very good at getting them urgently issued and so on. Conveyancing, probate, drawing up wills. I was slightly alarmed when somebody came in, drew up a will, and then promptly killed herself, I'm afraid. She wanted to leave all her money to a man she slightly coyly described as her nephew. And indeed she did. I hadn't quite realised what was going on there. I realised how important it is not to be nice to clients when they say they haven't got quite enough money to pay on account, and I was too generous to them, and they did a runner owing as much as £5, I think it was, in those days. You know, it was a great deal of money. It was a jolly time. It's a very nice firm in the on Richmond Green, a very jolly couple of years.
And then you applied to join the BBC in 1975, which is a pretty fundamental career change from your previous experience at Dixon Ward. So what was the main driver behind that change?
It was a whim, really. The story, which I've told many times, it's perfectly true. We had some friends who were working. One of them was working at the BBC as a secretary. She was working in the appointments department. And she told my wife, who was then training to be a journalist, has now managed to qualify as a journalist, if you can qualify as a journalist. She told my wife that the BBC had a training scheme for journalists. She said to my wife, did my wife want to apply? My wife was then on a newspaper training scheme, as newspapers had in those days. And my wife said no, she didn't want to apply to the BBC. She was quite happy in newspapers. And somebody, and I think it was my wife rather than these friends of ours, said to me, why don't you apply? And, you know, I'd watched my wife's training course from afar, not literally, but I'd watched what she was doing. And I thought it sounded rather fun. And the BBC training scheme said, candidates will be required to take a voice test, which sounded rather glamorous in a strange way. And I applied to the BBC scheme, as I say, on a whim. And I was shortlisted on the basis they didn't have many trainee solicitors who were applying. After being interviewed and after the voice test, I was offered a place. And then what should I do? You know, I was perfectly happy being a trainee solicitor. And I expect I would have qualified in due course, as indeed I did. If I stayed being a solicitor, my future was fairly clear as to what was to happen. If I joined the BBC as a trainee journalist, I had absolutely no idea what would happen to me. I take the view that one should always take opportunities when they come along. And I did. because otherwise you kick yourself. You say, what would have happened if I'd done this? And so I had to take the offer in order to find out what would happen to me. And I did, and I gave him my notice, and I stayed at the BBC for 25 years.
Yeah. And what aspect of working for the BBC did you enjoy most at that sort of initial stage?
Well, we were trainees, and we made dummy programmes. We made a radio programme every day as if it was real. And that meant going out to news stories, just like real journalists, and covering them. And to our surprise, because we regarded ourselves as trainees rather than as qualified, not that that means very much in journalism, but we certainly didn't have the experience. But much to our surprise, we tended to get to the scene of the crime, and it often was a crime, but wherever it was, before the real reporters working for the BBC newsroom. And occasionally, if we were the first there, we would get interviewed by real radio programmes we would actually broadcast. That was terribly exciting. And, you know, we realised, we learnt a lot about journalism. I learnt a lot from a friend of mine who still works for the BBC, who had spent 6 months working on a local radio station and had picked up some of the skills of radio before becoming a trainee. But we had a fascinating time doing our dummy programmes and broadcasting and interviewing, and it was great. And, you know, you learnt on the job. It was super. And if you made a mistake, it wasn't generally broadcast. And if it was broadcast, then it wasn't a mistake.
And obviously from that start, you launched the famous Law in Action series. So
yes.
What was the sort of spark behind that? What made you develop that feature?
It's curious. I think there was somebody very senior at the BBC at the time, possibly the chairman, a man called George Howard of Castle Howard. And I think he said to somebody on high, what are we doing about law? And of course, the one answer you don't give the chairman of the BBC is nothing. And so somebody, I imagine, said, oh, yes, we've got that Rosenberg chap. He's trained as a lawyer, and he's going to launch a radio series, and he's going to be standing in as legal correspondent and so on. I speculate. I don't know. All I know is that in about 1984, the BBC decided that it wanted to do wanted to devote more resources to specialist coverage of law. You have to remember that before that period, I say remember, you're too young to remember, but I mean, you have to know that before that period, they didn't have many specialist correspondents, certainly not in law, which was considered rather an obscure subject. The view was taken, certainly in television, that if you had specialists, they might know too much about the subject. And it was much better if you had a generalist who could come in the morning knowing nothing about the story, pick up enough during the day and broadcast in the evening, because if that individual could understand it, then it followed that the audience could understand it. Total fallacy, but that was the way they thought. And so they decided that they would try me out as legal affairs reporter. At the same time, they launched Law in Action, which was a current affairs programme on Radio 4. I had tried to launch that programme a couple of years earlier when I had been a BBC producer, but by then I'd switched to being a reporter. Great shift. The reporters have all the fun, the producers have all the money. They rise to become editors and bosses and in charge, and we're the people who do the broadcasting and we have the fun, but not the funds. We launched this programme to see what would happen. I was tried out as legal affairs reporter. It so happened that the National Union of Mine Workers were on strike in the winter of 84-85. This was striking against the Thatcher government. And the success or otherwise of the strike had a great deal to do with the law. All sorts of strange creatures descended from the gods, like sequestrators who were there to seize the miners' assets. And the official solicitor who was there to rescue Arthur Scargill, the mine workers' leader, from going to prison for contempt. There were lots and lots of legal issues involved. And these were terribly important legal issues because this was the mine workers against the government. And as far as the government was concerned, it didn't want to be defeated. So these were important issues, along with the industrial relations coverage, another area which isn't covered these days. Law was really important. Anyway, they thought I was doing okay. They decided to confirm the appointment after probationary period of 6 months, and then the mine workers' strike ended, and that was the end of that. But I carried on doing legal affairs, found things to do.
And in that series, obviously the miner strike was hugely important.
Yes.
But what would you say were the other programs from that series that were your sort of your greatest achievements, where you really got under the sort of skin of what was going on?
It's hard to say. I mean, I did that program for only 3 years at that time, from 84 to 87. And what I particularly remember was the efforts we went to get judges on the air, because in those days, judges wouldn't broadcast. And I remember travelling to Manchester with Lord Wolfe, as he later became, where he was going to deliver a lecture, the Harry Street Memorial Lecture. And I knew him, and I saw him on the train, and I chatted to him. You know, the normal way of dealing with his lecture for a Radio 4 audience would have been to record a short interview with him about the main points of what he was saying. And he was perfectly friendly, and still is. But he couldn't give me an interview, as the rules then stood, as it was seen in those days. So I had to go along and put the microphone of my tape recorder in front of him as he sat on the platform to deliver the lecture, to record his voice, just to get the voice of a judge on the radio. I remember Rose Heilbronn, who was the second woman to become a High Court judge, laying the foundation stone of what's called, I think, the Atkin Building at Gray's Inn at that time. And she, you know, declared the foundation stone duly laid, or whatever you do when you lay a foundation stone. And I held out my tape recorder microphone just to hear her voice saying, you know, I hereby lay this stone. And we went to these extraordinary lengths just to get to hear judges, because that was such an extraordinary thing. Now it's much easier. Not extremely easy, but it's still is much easier. And we just tried to do that pioneering thing. I also remember interviewing lawyers particularly who had never been interviewed before. And one who later made it to the Court of Appeal said that he was then a barrister. He said that the prospect of being interviewed by me was worse than going to the dentist. And I said, you know, but you are fearless. You stand up in the High Court, in the Court of Appeal, in the House of Lords. You know, your advocacy is superb. You appear to be totally in control. And he said, of course, it's what you're used to. And what he was not used to was being interviewed. And people would be interviewed, and they couldn't quite tell, they couldn't quite understand why the words that came out of their mouths were not as polished and as smooth and as articulate as the words that came out of the radio when other people were speaking. And what they had no idea about was how much effort we put into editing the interviews, which is very easy in radio, harder on television, in order to make them sound articulate, and the various effort we went to make people sound clear and simple. And they were fine, you know, once they were edited, but it took a bit of work.
So, moving on just briefly from the BBC for a moment, you moved into printed journalism.
Yes.
And you joined the Telegraph and then subsequently the Guardian.
Yeah.
So what were the sort of the key changes that you made to sort of adjust to that career move? How did that sort of differ from...
It was quite shocking, really, because I joined the Telegraph in 2000. The editor offered me a job. He offered me more money. If you work in television, at least you did in those days, you used to think newspapers were serious journalism, just as if you worked in newspapers, you used to think that television was the place to be. But having set this principle 25 years earlier, which is that you take offers when they come along, and Charles Moore, the editor of the Telegraph, said, you know, come and work for me, I thought, take the opportunity when it comes. That was probably a career mistake. When I got to the Telegraph, it was rather surprising. People had to share computers. I mean, this was 19 years ago, but even so, if you think about it, the BBC website started in 1997. So I was, you know, entirely familiar with online research for news and other things. And the idea that some people didn't have computer access to the internet and they had to share terminals was rather disturbing. The Telegraph was very underfunded. If you're wondering how the newspaper was produced, they had a very, very ancient computerized system unique to newspapers with its own set of terminals, which every so often would crash. And the word would go around the newsroom, save your copy, because the system was running slowly and the, you know, everything was about to disappear off the screen. So you would press save and hope that it saved and then would be rebooted. And when this system failed, as it often did, spare parts apparently had to be obtained from an obscure newspaper in Africa, which was the only country left in the world that still used this ancient system. It was extraordinary. So it was a bit of a culture shock doing this. But it was also quite interesting. I mean, I offered to join the paper a day earlier than I was scheduled to arrive because there was a very strong story that day. And I asked if they wanted me to cover it, and they first of all said no, and then they secondly said yes. So the first day I was officially working for them, I had what's called the splash, which means the front page lead story, the main story on the front page, which is a very good way to annoy all your future colleagues, you know. And I was writing this, as it happens, I was writing it from France because this was a man called David Shaler who was returning to face the music in London. He was a former MI5 agent who was wanted, and he decided to return, and I was writing this story about him returning. And I was amazed that the newspaper seemed to be trusting me with this important story on my first day, effectively working for them. And what I didn't realize is how much in newspapers somebody on the news desk can rewrite your copy and take in the agency stuff and put in what they want and make it sound right and look right. You can't really do that in broadcasting, because in broadcasting, if it's live, you're speaking, they're listening, nobody can stop you. If it's recorded, it's different, but if it's live, it's down to you. So I was surprised at how much latitude I got. But that's the great difference between newspapers and broadcasting.
And interestingly, I mean, to move from The Telegraph to The Guardian, which obviously have are the two ends of the political spectrum.
Yes.
Did you ever feel, because of your sort of your independent voice, in any way, not necessarily compromised, but pushed into a position where you were having to put your commentary with a particular spin that reflected the complexion of that paper, or did you always keep your sort of independence?
No, it was fine at The Guardian. The problem was The Telegraph, because, you know, when I left, or at the time I left, it was a slow departure from The Telegraph. I started, to begin with, I gave up being their legal editor, but I carried on writing a column for them, and then that went as well. But what made me resign from being their legal editor was what you've just alluded to. There was a particular story in The Telegraph. There was a particular story that day. It was a decision of the law lords. It was a case involving some soldiers, and they won their case. And the news desk said, you know, you've said that soldiers have got a declaration in their favour. Are they going to get compensation? And I said, no, they've got a declaration in their favour, but they're not going to get any money. And the news desk said, it would be a much better story if they got compensation. I said, it would be a better story if they got compensation, but that's not what happened. And then they said, the Evening Standard says today that these soldiers could get compensation. And I said, well, you know, there's a lot in the word could, but, you know, my story is that they've won, but they're not going to get compensation. And then the news desk said, well, maybe you could do a joint story with yourself and the defense correspondent and see if there's another way you could write it. And the defense correspondent said, well, what's going to happen to these soldiers? Will they get compensation? The answer is no. So, you know, the story didn't change. And then when it appeared the next day, the story that was published said soldiers could get compensation. And this was picked up by one of the judges in the case, who said that my analysis on the inside page was fine. This was a column, a lengthy column, but the story on the front page was inaccurate. And I said, yep, it was inaccurate. and that's when I felt I had to leave the Telegraph. Mm-hmm. The Guardian, I was never on the staff, but when I left the Telegraph, the Guardian was looking for a legal column, and so I simply wrote a column for them every week for not very much money until the Guardian ran out of money, and they said they simply couldn't afford me. The Guardian, you know, has got slightly better, but it was in very dire straits when I left them. And that was that. I went down to one a fortnight instead of once a week, and then they said, we can't even afford that. And they weren't paying very much. I mean, it's extraordinary, really. So that all stopped. Newspapers are in a bad way.
Well, that segues beautifully to my next question, which is really, as well as the financial pressures, and perhaps we can sort of come back to that, what do you think are the greatest challenges that the printed press faces at the moment, and what do you think are the consequences for the consumers of news as a result of these challenges?
And the problem is that the consumers of news are not, generally speaking, willing to pay for the news that they consume. So they don't buy newspapers on the whole. They don't particularly subscribe to newspapers that are behind paywalls. They look at advertising, but that's not really enough. And newspapers cost a lot of money to produce. And the fewer people who read them and buy them, effectively the more they cost to produce. And that's not helped by huge investments in printing presses, as the Guardian did, in, you know, what was short-sighted but understandable, but a terrible mistake, you know, huge amounts of money wasted. So it's very difficult to carry on with newspapers unless you've got somebody prepared to subsidise them through other means. And they are having to compete. They are having to cut costs. And it's a tricky situation. We rely on them. You know, we trust them. We hope that they will provide us with the information that we need, but they are having to do so with fewer and fewer resources, less and less money, and that's because people no longer read newspapers in the way they did. People no longer commute. I mean, possibly here to the city, people still arrive on trains in the morning, but nobody reads a newspaper as they would have 20 years ago, and if they do, it might be a free sheet. So it's all changed. You know, news has changed a great deal. You know, we all know what we look at if we look at anything on the train, and that's the phone you've got sitting there and I've got in my pocket here.
I mentioned in my introduction that you've also written a number of books, and from reading some of these works, there seems to be a common theme, and I don't know if the audience has read any of Joshua's books. If you haven't, I really recommend that you do. They are excellent. But the theme that came across to me was how often you have written about topics that, after you have written about them, have become the hot topic of the day. So they seem very prescient. So first of all, I want to know where you hide your crystal ball to be able to spot these hot topics. But yes, just to really sort of get behind how, with your books on, say, for example, constitutional reform and privacy in the press, which you wrote well before the Millie Dowler and sort of Leveson inquiry, but clearly brings up a lot of the themes that you cover in your book. How did you manage to identify what clearly have become, I think, some of the biggest issues of the day? What were your connections? What were your thought processes in putting together your books?
I think the only answer I can give is that I write about current affairs. And although books have an extraordinary six-month time lag between completion and publication, on the whole, they may still be current at the time they're published. I certainly don't claim to be prescient. I mean, my next book, which is not due out until April, but I've got the page proofs today, and certainly I finished the writing of it. It was meant to be finished on the 1st of September. I managed to extend that long enough to get the prorogation case in, the Miller No. 2 and Cherry case in the Supreme Court. But it's only squeezed in a couple of places to make it look as up-to-date as possible. You know, maybe those issues will still be current by next spring. Maybe they won't be. The Privacy and the Press book was very good luck because I wrote it just at the time that the cases were developing and before the issue settled down a bit. So it remained reasonably current for a while. I suppose it still is reasonably current. There was a period the privacy law was being developed before the Human Rights Act came into effect, but it was given a big boost by the Human Rights Act. Obviously, that took effect in 2000. The book, I think, was completed in 2003, 2004. There was an update and so on, and finally sort of out in 2005. And it was at that point that the law had said we had a privacy law. One had been created, and we still do, and it's still there. So, you know, it is luck. In one of my books, I said what a good idea it would be to abolish the system under which the Lord Chancellor was the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary all rolled into one. And that happened. I'm not so sure it's quite such a good idea. Having seen it happen, I now begin to think that there was some advantage in the old system, but it couldn't be retained. My books tend to be what's going on at the moment and what interests me, what I write down.
Yes, and clearly your writing shows your passion and interest for constitutional law and reform, which again has proved to be probably the hottest topic of the last sort of three years. Mm. So from your sort of experience and your connection with writing about constitutional law, what do you think about the Constitution at the moment? How well is it performing with the challenges from Brexit, from prorogation, the independence of the judiciary, and so on and so forth?
It's certainly under strain. The book that is coming out next spring is called Enemies of the People, with a question mark. And that, of course, relates to the first Miller judgment and the criticism of the High Court, the Divisional Court's decision by the Daily Mail, which used that headline to refer to the three judges who found that legislation was required to trigger Brexit. When we had the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court, there was some criticism of the judiciary, but it was much more muted. I quote a government minister who was muttering aggressively against the judges, no doubt with the encouragement of Downing Street. But it wasn't anything like as bad as it was 3 years ago. Lord Sumption, in his recollections this year, said that if the courts appear to be too political, then there will be pressure for vetting of potential judges. And indeed, when we got the decision of the Supreme Court, there was some call for that. It didn't get very far, and it was firmly rejected by the government. So there are definite tensions, because, you know, it would be a bad thing. Now, we saw the problems of recruiting people to the High Court. The High Court is under strength, significantly under strength. They can't get the judges. But they have got at least one very good recruit to the judiciary who joined 6 weeks ago and who got his knighthood with the other judges last week. He is somebody who is very, very promising, somebody to tip for the top, only because he's 45 and therefore has plenty of time to make his way up the hierarchy. Whereas there are worrying signs, people don't apply, there are good signs in that good people do apply. And it's a balance. So I'm not particularly worried. I rather admire the flexibility of the common law, the flexibility of the uncodified constitution, and the ability of the different parts of the constitution to do what some people think of as rather radical things, but nevertheless to make up for the imbalance caused by other parts of the Constitution. The example, obviously, is the Supreme Court effectively declaring the prorogation of Parliament as not to have happened. And if you like, although this is more controversial, the Speaker allowing legislation to be passed effectively by backbenchers telling the government what to do. These are all things which are on the edge of the Constitution, but nevertheless, I think, are ways of the Constitution trying to revert to the centre, which is where it should be.
I think, sort of harking back to the first Miller case, which generated the enemies of the people comment in the Mail, I think at that point many people in the profession did feel at rock bottom that this was the public perception of one strand of the profession. And I know at the University of Law we certainly sort of thought about it and wondered whether some of the blame could lie at our own door, in that perhaps as a profession we had not promoted ourselves clearly enough to the public to retain that trust in us as professionals, or whether, as other people said, it was the fault of Liz Truss, who was the then Lord Chancellor, who didn't respond and react by defending the High Court judges who'd made that decision. So do you think there's somewhere in between there that all roads sort of lead to the sort of the fall in status of the profession?
It's very, very difficult for the profession to persuade people who won't listen that lawyers are not fat cats. The Daily Mail at the time under Paul Dacre would not accept that at all, and went out of its way to insult lawyers just as it insulted the judges. Dacre's no longer editor, things have changed. But if certain elements of the press are determined to push a myth, a trope, then it's very, very difficult to show otherwise. That's not to say you shouldn't try. I think you should try. I think, you know, lawyers should demonstrate as much as they can the pro bono work they do and the other work they do for the benefit of society. You know, the City of London depends on a strong legal profession, bringing in work from outside. And it's very good at trying to push that message, but, you know, it's very difficult for people to grasp that. So the more that institutions can do to persuade the public that lawyers are okay and actually, you know, valuable ways of generating funds, and funds is good for the economy, and the economy is good for us all, and so on, you know, that's all good. One problem with the judgment in the Enemies of the People case in the High Court was that the judges didn't actually spell out that all that was required to resolve the problem that they appeared to have created was legislation. And as things looked at that time, it would not be difficult to get the legislation through, and indeed it was not difficult to get the legislation through. Now, they were handing to Parliament the opportunity to block Brexit, and maybe some of the judges secretly hoped that MPs would block Brexit. But the reality at the time was that MPs felt the need to allow Brexit to go ahead, and it seemed inevitable to us, and this was certainly proved by the event, that the bill that the Prime Minister was required to bring in order to trigger Brexit would be easily passed, and indeed it was. You know, we're talking about 2017. Things were different then. The judges didn't spell that out. Now, judges don't spell out the consequences of their judgments, but it was a bit of a missed opportunity. Whether that would have persuaded the newspapers to treat it differently, I don't know, but it might just have slightly changed the narrative. So, sure, the more one can do to explain all this sort of thing to the public, the better.
So as well as the future of the Constitution and the freedom of the press, which you have covered so well in your writing and your broadcasting, what do you think are going to be the big issues for lawyers in the future? What are going to be the new hot topics?
I went to the launch today, not very far from here, of a paper on cyber assets and cryptocurrencies. Have I got that right? I must look it up because I do know what these words mean, but as Geoffrey Voss, Chancellor of the Chancery Division, said today, this paper is not for nerds. It's actually for real people, and this is something that is quite easy to understand without the wet towel around your head if you actually apply yourself to it. So I think that this is actually something where the UK, England and Wales is ahead of all other jurisdictions, and it's something that is going to become increasingly important. It's something that people ought to get to know and understand. It's very interesting. This is not, it's a very curious thing. This is people who are interested in this topic commissioning some lawyers who know about these things to put together a paper which sets out to answer the question of whether these assets, crypto assets and smart contracts, that's what it is, whether crypto assets are property or not, and if so, can they be treated as property or not? The short answer is they can be treated as property, but you have to understand how they work and why they're property. And what this is, what this amounts to is showing that the common law can adapt much more readily to a new class of assets than civil law countries where you need legislation and codes to do so. And this is a way in which the jurisdiction here in the City of London and England and Wales generally hope to steal a march on foreign courts. All this sounds, you know, extremely mysterious, and you know, we're a bit suspicious of Bitcoin all the stuff that goes with these public keys and ledgers and you know, all this stuff. But it's terribly important, and I intend to, perhaps if I wasn't speaking to you tonight, I'd spend the evening reading through this paper. But I do recommend it online. It is the future.
Excellent. I was obviously looking to the audience now, many of whom are sort of partway through their careers. What advice would you give to anyone sort of starting out now with a career in law, given the sort of opportunities that you've had and the serendipity in your career that you were talking about earlier? What would you advise them to do?
Keep to the day job and don't try journalism, because journalism, as I've made, I hope, clear, has relatively little future. That doesn't mean you can't write a bit in your spare time. Indeed, the skills of journalism are very useful to any lawyer, whether the lawyer is writing opinions, letters, articles for websites, firm or chambers publish, or whatever. You know, literacy skills are well worth developing. But in terms of making money out of it, no, stick to the day job. I mean, there is this whole issue of the fact that there are too many students facing too few jobs. And that, you know, sadly, some students delude themselves into thinking that they're going to get training contracts and pupillages when they're not. And this is all very sad. But I'm sure that the people here in the room are the cream of the cream, and some of you have, you know, I mean, you all look terribly young to me, but some of you clearly are in practice already. And therefore, you've already got the first step on the ladder. But my impression is that, although it wasn't easy for us, it's much harder now.
I think that's right. So, on a personal level, and I say this with a so far in front of it, so far, what do you think are your sort of your greatest achievements? What are you most proud of? What would you put as your sort of top three things that you've done in your career to date that you blush about a little?
Well, journalism involves a great deal of luck. Some of it you have to exploit the luck. I'll tell you a story from long ago when I was still being tried out as a reporter, because I was a reporter for a couple of years before I was a legal correspondent, and before I was a reporter, I was, in the BBC terminology, on attachment, meaning I was being lent to the newsroom to see if I could crack it. And I was driving home one evening through West London and listening to the radio, and at 1 minute to seven in the evening, there was a traffic alert saying that Earls Court was blocked. Earls Court Road was blocked. And at 1 minute past seven, there was a news report saying that there had been a shooting incident in Earls Court, but nobody knew what was going on. There were no details at the moment. And I thought, well, I'm not very far away. I'm meant to be a reporter. I've got a tape recorder in the boot of my car. I'll go and have a look. So I went along there. And this incident had happened a couple of hours earlier. And in the middle of the road, I don't think it's Earls Court Road, but it's the adjoining one, there was a mini car with its doors wide open in the middle of the road and no traffic. And, you know, it was a crime scene. It turned out that the driver of the car had been shot by the police, which was fairly unusual. And in the circumstances, nobody was saying anything, but all the press were being told to go to the local police station in Earls Court Road by the police in order that they could be kept sitting there and told absolutely nothing at all. And I was working for radio, and I looked around, and there was a block of flats overlooking the scene of the crime. And in one of the, and they had balconies, and in one of the balconies, I could see a television crew. It was winter, it was dark, and in those days, television crews consisted of camera operators, sound operators, and lighting operators. And there was a chap with a battery light holding an arm like that with a light down, showing, lighting the face of somebody who was being interviewed with her back to the scene of the crime, and there was a camera in the building. So it was very clear that this was on the third floor and that this was quite easy to find. So I went into the block of flats. It was easy enough to get in, walked up to the third floor, and just got to the flat where this woman had been interviewed just as the television crew were finished. I said to the woman, "You've just done BBC television. Do you mind doing an interview for BBC radio?" She said, "Fine." So I interviewed her. And she said that she thought that she had seen the police surround a car and shoot the driver. And I said, "Oh, that's very interesting. Thank you very much." And I did the recording, rang the office, said, "I've got an interview with an eyewitness." They said, "Great, great, because we can't find anything, because our reporter's stuck in the police station. They won't tell her anything." So I said, "Fine, well, I'll drive back to Broadcasting House with the tape." There it was, the first eyewitness radio report suggesting that the police had shot this chap. They were terribly pleased because this was, you know, the first inkling that something terrible had happened. The police had shot the wrong man. It was awful. He recovered, but, you know, he was shot. I had got this by following the television crew, and the television crew had got this by taking advantage of the lighting operator who was the best journalist around and who had knocked on every door in this block of flats overlooking the scene of a crime, saying, "Anybody here speak English and did you see anything?" You know, as you say in a classic foreign affairs reporting, "Anybody see the scene of the crime?" So this lighting person was the best journalist around. And after that, the BBC scrapped lighting people because they thought that, you know, you can stick a light on the camera and you don't need a lighting operator. But no, he was terrific, you know, and I owe my career to him.
Oh. That's a wonderful story. Now, I'm very aware of time, and I'm going to hand you over to the audience in a moment to see if they've got any questions they want to ask you. But just one final question from me, and obviously it's a slightly surreal moment for me to be interviewing a journalist. So I'm going to ask you, what question would you ask yourself that I haven't covered to have covered this interview properly?
I think that's a very good question. I think I'm going to pass. I think I'm going to say that I would get you to ask me whatever question it is that the first person from the audience is going to ask me.
Excellent response. So if I can now hand over to the audience. I think have we got some roving mics? I think that would be helpful if we had those so that everybody can hear the question. So I've got to ask, first of all, has anybody got a question? Yes, lots of hands.
Hi. I was really interested in the political aspects you were talking about with legal reporting recently, with the Brexit judgments. I work in civil liberties, which is often felt increasingly under scrutiny from the papers. Do you think that's getting worse, or is my naivety just disappearing as I do this for longer? I'm thinking particularly of some of the Theresa May's comments when she was Prime Minister about, I think we were left-wing activist lunatics was the subtext.
Well, I don't know if it's getting worse. It's certainly essential that campaign groups of all sorts make their voice heard. I think you do have the advantage that, first of all, trust in politicians is going down, generally speaking. And you know, I say that neutrally of all politicians. Secondly, opportunities for campaign groups to make their voices heard are getting greater all the time. Whereas a few years ago, an organisation like Liberty would have found it difficult to get reports into the newspapers, nowadays you don't need reports in the newspapers. You email your supporters, you put things on your website, you do videos, you know, YouTube, all the stuff that you do in order to get your voice heard. I spend... we haven't spoken about Twitter, for example, and I look to Twitter for a breaking news story. I also look to see whether somebody else has put the story out that I've got before I have, for example, a judgment from the court, because I try and provide a service to people by putting out breaking stories. They may not be exclusive stories, but they are breaking stories, and I expect to see breaking stories on Twitter. And, you know, if Liberty wins a case, or even if it loses, I will expect to see a tweet or two or three summarising the result and linking me to a web page with the consequences. So you have plenty of opportunities to get your views out. And I don't think it's getting any worse. I mean, it is a fact that the present government has said that it does not intend to repeal the Human Rights Act. There has been a great deal of concern that that's the next thing on the present government's agenda. But it has said that that's not what it proposes to do. It said that last week with the story about soldiers. Now, you may be concerned at the proposal to amend the Human Rights Act, but whether that'll happen or not, we wait to see. But the government doesn't intend to repeal the Human Rights Act and does not intend to withdraw from the Human Rights Convention. So, you know, that's one of the fears that organisations like Liberty have had, which appears to be unjustified. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't be vigilant. Of course, you should. But it's not quite as bad as it might be, for all the reasons we know.
You've touched on it with your new book title, but Enemies of the People was a big headline at the time. What do you think judges can do to be more public-facing and to get the public to understand what is a really complicated subject? My background before I started my training contract was child protection, and there's lots of Facebook groups for parents that are very angry about the work we do. But actually, on balance, the right decisions are made, but judges can't put their side of the story out there. The judgments are there, but that's not always enough.
And child protection, you're referring to what? Anything specifically? I mean, what are you talking about, private law cases?
My background's care, yeah, but okay. Anything kind of baby PN onwards.
Well, on the private law side, I interviewed Andrew McFarlane, president of the Family Division, last week, about a particular concern that we raised, which was domestic abuse in contact cases. In other words, what should happen when parents split up and one parent, typically the father, doesn't have to be the father, is either suspected of or has been convicted of domestic abuse. Should that parent have contact with his, typically, child or not? If you say yes, unsupervised contact, you may put the child at risk. If you say no contact, that's regarded as damaging to the child. And the judges have to decide. And begin with, obviously, they have to look for evidence, and to get evidence takes time, several months sometimes. And do you allow the parent to see the child in the interim or not? And there's no easy answer. It's a very difficult question for judges to deal with. And McFarlane was very happy to be interviewed on this subject. He had various suggestions, nothing very extraordinary. But he did, you know, acknowledge this was a problem and that occasionally judges would get it wrong with tragic consequences. And we broadcast this on Law in Action last week, and I wrote it up in the Law Society Gazette. The piece is out today. So they can talk about this sort of subject if they are given an opportunity to do so in a serious way to a serious audience. And they do, and they're willing to do so. This despite the fact that we are meant to be in purdah, and therefore everything is meant to be off-limits. Purdah, of course, is, you know, pending a general election. Governments aren't meant to say anything controversial. The government, have gone to enormous lengths to try and stop bodies for which they're responsible from doing anything remotely controversial. So the Law Commission, with which I have an association, wasn't even allowed to publish or publicise a lecture it had commissioned from Lady Hale last week. I mean, it's going to go on the judicial website, but not on the Law Commission website till after the election. It's quite extraordinary. But the judges, on the whole, are quite happy to talk. Provided they're given an opportunity and provided it's taken seriously, it's all to the good. It's, of course, very easy for newspapers to sensationalise this, and judges have got to be quite careful, but they are willing to talk, much more so than, as I was saying, when we started Law in Action all those years ago. Over there, if you like.
Hi, good evening. I guess my question is, with all the tension in terms of the political climate at the moment, do you feel that our checks and balance system, despite the fact that we don't have a written constitution and we have, you know, enshrined principles, whether that check and balance system is under attack at the minute, just given in terms of what the government as the executive branch is willing to try to fudge almost its way in introducing various things, some of it that public aren't aware of, and some of it as recent as what they try to do now. And thank God we have a sound judicial system that kind of checks them. But I'm just thinking in terms of the judiciary and the press, who are the pillars of checking and balance, whether they are coming under attack.
You're right to be concerned, but I think to some extent you've answered the question, which is that the judiciary are alive to this and are willing to step in. Now, you know, whatever you think of the decision of the Supreme Court in the prorogation case Miller No. 2 / Cherry, and obviously it overturned the decision of the High Court of England and Wales, this did show that the judges were willing to step in and do so in a very persuasive way by, you know, getting everybody to agree. This unanimous judgment carried great authority. And the message was if you, Prime Minister, are going to go further than the unwritten conventions of the Constitution expect you to do, then we, the Supreme Court, will find a way of stopping you doing this. I mean, this is fairly high-stakes stuff, but in another way, it's just what the courts do. And I spoke to one judge the following day who said, well, what was surprising about that decision? It's just judicial review, government exceeds its powers, and therefore it's told that its decision is void. And that's the basis of judicial review throughout. The fact that these were prerogative powers and that we'd never had a judgment in this area before didn't alter the fact that this was straightforward courts saying, you can't do this. Now, if Parliament wanted to, Parliament could take over the prerogative power. It could pass legislation saying the decision on dissolving Parliament is one for Parliament itself, not for the Prime Minister exercising prerogative powers on behalf of Her Majesty. And then, of course, the courts would have to rule on that. I also mentioned the other side of the story, which was arguably more of a problem for the Prime Minister, which was the so-called Benn Act, the legislation which required him to ask the EU for the extension, which, of course, the EU granted, and we are where we are. So I prefer the flexibility of our uncodified constitution, which seems well able to push against bulges in the system to block ministers who fail to follow conventions, than I would be with attempts to write a constitution which would take ages, which would be inflexible, which the government would hijack, and wouldn't really deal with whatever problems are going to arise. I'm reasonably sanguine about the constitution, provided the judiciary remains strong and provided Parliament remains strong. Now, you could say that Parliament is too strong, and I've heard this said. I gave a lecture a couple of weeks ago, and somebody, a very distinguished lawyer, said, surely Boris Johnson should have advised Her Majesty not to give royal assent to the Benn Bill, the bill that said he had to ask for an extension. And I said, well, you would have had rioting on the streets. That would have been appalling. The last monarch to do that was Queen Anne. He said, well, I'm not sure, because he took the view that Parliament was there to endorse the government, to give legislative support to the government, but ultimately the government was in charge. And I said, no, that's not how I read the Constitution. Sovereignty is with the Parliament. Sovereignty of Parliament involves the Commons, the Lords generally, and the Sovereign, and it's not for Parliament to say that it can tell, it's not for the government to take over that third power, the power of the Sovereign, to assent to legislation. So I'm reasonably relaxed about it. I think the system will work itself out, but it's very interesting, and I can see why you're alarmed. It is alarming. But you just hope that, you know, there are enough people in power to ensure that the powers that be do what they're meant to do.
Our 60 minutes with Joshua are up, and so I suggest that we conclude the event in terms of the Q&A, but I'm sure Joshua will take questions after we finish this part of the event. But I really want to just say, by way of conclusion, a huge thank you to Joshua for giving up his time this evening to come to speak to us. I'm sure we've all learned an enormous amount from listening to what he has to say. I know I have, and I'm scribbling notes furiously about the hard chairs and the overfast lectures, as well as all the incredible insights about the Constitution, the press, and his own career. So I hope you'll join me in thanking Joshua enormously for being here with us.